From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Raphael Scharf has spent his life documenting the Holocaust. Most of his family died in the Auschwitz death camp, which was close to his home. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear his story, and he'll tell us how he found the photographs for his book on the Warsaw Ghetto. The pictures were taken by a German soldier in the ghetto on a summer day in 1941. Also, we'll hear about a chilling trend in historical revisionism, denying the Holocaust ever happened. We'll hear from historian Deborah Lipstadt, author of a book investigating this pseudo-scholarship. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review The Pelican Brief, the second thriller this year based on a John Grisham novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State Warren Christopher said today that the United States is still determined to restore Haiti's elected government to power. The assurance came in reaction to reports that the administration has given up hopes of restoring ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The reports came after Haitian Prime Minister Robert Malval said this week that he was canceling plans for a national conference to discuss the country's political standoff. President Aristide said on Monday that he was opposed to such a conference because he didn't believe that the present conditions in Haiti would allow an open debate. A former top official of the U.S. House of Representatives was sentenced to 2 years in jail today for his role in the House banking scandal. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Jack Russ was the House Sergeant-at-Arms, a high-ranking administrative post appointed by the Speaker. In October, he pleaded guilty to 3 felony counts of embezzling money from the House bank. Russ cashed 17 checks with insufficient funds at the bank, embezzling $75,000 that was eventually paid back. His intentional embezzlement was considered far more serious than the simple overdrafts at the bank by scores of lawmakers. Russ's overdrafts led prosecutors to other crimes, including defrauding investors in Russ's private flag-making business of more than $400,000. Russ had appealed to be sentenced to 10 months, with half that in home detention, but prosecutors argued for the stiffer sentence, saying Russ had crossed the line and dipped into the public till for private profit. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
North Korea has condemned the United States and its latest offer to resolve the dispute over nuclear inspections. NPR's Marjorie Sun reports from Seoul.
In a statement issued by the government news agency, North Korea's foreign ministry suggested it would consider cutting off dialogue with Washington. It stopped short of outright rejecting the U.S. proposal, but North Korea made no counteroffer of its own. It's widely believed North Korea, isolated and economically poor, is developing a nuclear weapon. That's because North Korea has refused since last spring to allow an international agency to inspect 2 suspected nuclear sites. North Korea insists the sites are for civilian purposes. UN Secretary General Boutros-Boutros-Ghali leaves for Asia tomorrow and plans to visit North Korea during his trip, presumably to try to persuade leaders in Pyongyang to be more flexible. In Seoul, I'm Marjorie Sun.
Stock prices closed out the week with a big gain today, inflated by trading connected with the so-called triple witching hour, when options and futures expire at the end of a quarter. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 25 points to close at 3,752. Advances led declines by a margin of more than 2-to-1 in heavier trading of 357 million shares. This is NPR. The Walmart company is being sued on a claim that employees at a Texas Walmart were negligent when they sold a gun to a mentally ill man who later used it to kill both his parents. The suit was brought by relatives of Mike Brantley Alford, a schizophrenic man who killed his parents in September and later hanged himself in jail. The suit alleges that Alford initially acknowledged that he had received treatment for mental illness on a federal reporting form. It said he changed his answer on the form after a Walmart clerk told him that the answer would disqualify him for a gun purchase. Political leaders in Chicago are launching a bipartisan effort to attract both the Democratic and Republican national conventions to the city in 1996. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
Through the middle of the 20th century, centrally located Chicago hosted more political nominating conventions than any other city, but neither party has held its quadrennial gathering there since the 1968 Democratic Convention. That event was marked by bitter divisions in the convention hall and by police and National Guard attacks against anti-war demonstrators in the streets. Republican and Democratic officials in Illinois believe the passage of 25 years has softened the memories of those clashes, and they're willing to spend at least $20 million trying to convince both of the major parties to locate their next national conventions in Chicago. Neither party has indicated where it will meet, but the Democrats, at least, may be influenced by the fact that their national chair, David Wilhelm, cut his political teeth in the city. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
Publishing billionaire Walter Annenberg has pledged $500 million to reform public education and curb violence in the schools. Annenberg announced the gift today at a White House ceremony, saying that he sees education as the only way to guarantee the nation's future. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Holocaust survivors have asked us to never forget. Two things this year have helped keep the Holocaust in the public consciousness: the opening of the Holocaust Museum and now the film Schindler's List. On this archive edition of our program, we're going to hear an interview we recorded last April on the 50th anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. After the Germans invaded Poland in 1939, all the Jews of Warsaw, about 138,000 people, were herded into the ghetto, which was walled off from the rest of the city in 1940. Thousands of Jews died of starvation and disease. Thousands of others had been sent to the gas chambers. 50 years ago, when German soldiers came to destroy the ghetto, they were fought off by Jews with Molotov cocktails, stones, and handmade weapons. The Jews could never have won, but they heroically resisted the Germans for 3 weeks. Raphael Scharf edited a book of never-before-published photographs taken in the ghetto one summer day in 1941. Scharf is a Polish Jew who lost most of his family in the Holocaust. He now lives in England, where he has set up the Library of Holocaust Survivors. The pictures in his new book were taken by a German soldier named Willie George. Scharf tracked down these photos as soon as he heard about their existence.
I found myself on the doorstep of the soldier photographer. I entered, accompanied by some of my friends, and it did in fact transpire that this gentleman, whom I was facing in his own home, 50 years ago, almost to a day, entered the Warsaw Ghetto. Now, he was, by profession, a photographer. Hence, of course, the quality of the pictures that he took. Anyway, he entered the ghetto at about 10 o'clock in the morning, armed with his Leica, an early model, and started taking snapshots. Now, the landscape, the human landscape, which he found, was, of course, totally unexpected to him. He didn't quite understand what he was seeing, but it was so unusual and exotic that he took a great number of snaps.
Had this soldier been told to take pictures by his commander?
Can I expand at length? Have we got time to tell you? During the war, I was in the British Army in the intelligence corps, and my task was interrogating German prisoners of war. Now, when I found myself face to face with a former German soldier, all my antennae started vibrating. Now, I knew more about the scene than he did. Now, trying to get the facts from him, who sent him there, what was he seeing, how did he feel about it, all that I very soon realized with my past experience, this was quite futile. What we are talking about was something which happened 50 years ago. The man was now about 80. That day in the ghetto was not at that time a tremendous event in his life. In fact, to the point that when he took these snapshots and sent them to his wife, he forgot all about them. And it's only very, very recently, because he's getting old and making order in his drawers, that he discovered these films. So I realized there was not much point interrogating him on that score, because, like all the German prisoners of war under interrogation, he was telling me not what he really remembered or felt, but what he thought I wanted to hear.
What did he tell you?
Well, he told me, now the bare story is that he was known in his group, he was of a very, very humble rank. In his group it was known that he had a camera, and to make himself pocket money, like soldiers do, he used to take snapshots of his colleagues to send home. So his commanding officer knew that he was a photographer, and I think out of sheer curiosity, since the unit was stationed within an earshot of the Warsaw Ghetto, he asked him, gave him a pass, so Willy Georg tells me, and he entered the ghetto and started taking the snapshots. Now, this was not allowed. Photographs other than the official photographs, which were taken on occasions, were not allowed. Now, he was lucky that he roved through the ghetto freely until towards the evening. He was, in fact, apprehended by the German police, who forced him to open the camera and destroy the film that was in it. But he did not tell them, and I put this to his credit, he did not tell them that he already had four rolls in his pocket. Now, after that, he was pushed out of the ghetto, and as he tells me, he went immediately to a photographic studio, a Polish photographic studio outside the ghetto walls, and developed the film. Now, he's terribly, terribly proud of his, and justly so, of his professional competence, that these films, 50 years on, are as crisp, as fresh, as if they were taken yesterday.
You write at the end of the book, to many of us who grew up within or next to that human landscape and who remember it lovingly, these people, shameful to confess, did not at that time look attractive. These misty eyes, beards, side locks, crooked noses. One looked away, embarrassed by what a non-Jewish onlooker might feel or say. Could you expand a little bit about that, on that complicated feeling that you express?
Did I write that? What you read to me, did I write that? How very well put. Well, look, one could write volumes on this. There was a vast section of the population of Jews in Poland who were indistinguishable from the Polish population around them. Assimilated, both in dress, in speech, in interests, in dedication to ideals, differing from the Polish neighbors only by origin, by religion, which they often did not practice anyway. Now then, there was another section of the population which was Orthodox, both in dress, in manners, in interest, and they might just as well have lived in any other country and retained their appearance and habits as they did in Poland. A great many of them, for all I know, of that section, never spoke to a Pole in their lives. They lived within a Jewish society which was self-sufficient, and you could be born and grow up and study and die and marry and have children and be surrounded by Jews alone. There were such large centers of Jews in Poland. And one of them, of course, the largest of all, was in Warsaw. So what we see here in these pictures, these faces, which I then describe somewhere as Rembrandtesque, these bearded with misty eyes, with crooked noses and so on, they do in fact represent this section of the population which I just described.
My guest is Raphael Scharf, editor of the book In the Warsaw Ghetto, Summer 1941. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Raphael Scharf, founder of the Library of Holocaust Survivors in England.
The photographs are accompanied by Warsaw Ghetto diaries that that you've chosen.
Yes.
Are these diaries that you found, or are they collected in archives? How did you get them?
No, this is public property. I have no proprietary rights to the diaries. They do exist. Now, what one has to bear in mind is that in one respect, the Germans were very unlucky in the choice of their victims. They chose very literary people. Everybody felt that what was happening was so startling, so unusual, so unbelievable, that it had to be put on record. Now, a great, great many people, since among the Jews there are a great many people who are literate, started writing and putting these things on record. Now, all that might not have reached us if not for the idea and the work of one single person by the name of Emanuel Ringelblum, a historian and sociologist, who had this idea that everything had to be recorded. And he organized a network of people which spread through the country, not only in Warsaw, to write all that they saw, to supply labels, all printed matters, documents which they came across, posters which they stripped off the wall, and brought it to him to form the archives of the ghetto. Now, when the noose started tightening, and he himself, although he and his wife and his son lived at that time hidden outside the ghetto, he felt that his days might be numbered, and he organized a group of people who collected all those archives, that is, all the reports that he received, the posters, the labels, all the written matter by adults and by children, and sealed them in milk churns and steel boxes and buried them under an address which is known to us in Warsaw. Now, virtually everything that we know of what was happening there at the time is due to the materials which come from the Ringelblum archives. Now, these archives were partly, unfortunately only partly, recovered after the war, some of it already in 1945 or 6, some of it in 1950, and the rest is lost.
Emanuel Ringelblum, who gathered all these materials, he did not survive the war.
He did not survive. He was denounced, and police came for him and took him. Actually, he did not live. He lived in a garden house of a Polish peasant, and was taken to the, actually we know that, to the ground of the ghetto and shot with he and his wife and his son. And he, I think, is the great unsung hero of those times.
I wonder if anybody, if you know if anybody in your family kept memoirs during the war.
Look, you speak of my family. Just by a coincidence, you might say, if I'm to speak of my family, the majority of them on my father's side come from a little town not far from Krakow called Oświęcim, which became Auschwitz. Now, in that Oświęcim, which was then accursed with the name Auschwitz, the majority of the population were Jews, and among them, the clan of Scharfs. I have counted myself now from memory, relatives, there were over 50 people whom I listed. Now, among them, there is not a single survivor. They did not have far to go. Now, if you ask me whether any of them kept diaries, they may have done, because they were on the whole very literate, being of long rabbinical stock, but they have not reached me.
Well, you have a library of survivors' material in England, a library of diaries and memoirs of survivors. Tell me why you decided to set that up.
Look, this... I'm not alone in this. I'm alive when the rest of them are dead. And I've always felt that duty, that having survived, I owe something to those who have not survived. And how am I to pay that debt other than by cultivating the memory and trying to make those who want to forget not to allow them to forget. So within my modest means, I'm no great scholar, I'm immersed, you could say, day and night in those materials to the virtual exclusion of other reading matter, which I think is an enormous impoverishment. But when I take up a book to read for pleasure, I feel that I'm wasting time. I'm not allowed to do it.
Can I ask how you got out of Poland during the war?
Well, no, I didn't. No, I came down. I came to England just before the war. I left Poland before the war. I was a foreign correspondent to a Polish Jewish newspaper in Krakow, and I came to London already in 1938. So that's one more reason. I was not really a part of it. All my burden that I carry is the, you could say, the burden of an absentee. I was not there myself.
How did you know to get out?
I didn't. I got out. Lots of people got out. I didn't get out because had I known what was happening, I would have got out not only myself, but I would have carried my family with me perhaps. No, I had no idea what will happen. And although in retrospect it looks almost silly to say that one didn't know the war was coming, it was not all that obvious. I came to England. I was struck by this enormous power of the British Empire. And since this was for all the world to see, didn't Hitler see this? Would he dare? That's how it looked at that time. Now, in retrospect, it looks silly. But I did not get out of Poland because I thought that the war was coming. Had I known that the war was coming, I would think twice about getting out.
You got out for professional reasons?
For professional reasons. Also, I was a little bit tired of life in Poland. I saw wide horizons. And if truth be told, I saw England, as it were, as a staging post only in my journey to Palestine, where I wanted to land eventually.
Can you tell us a little bit more what it was like when you, the first time you went back to Poland?
Now, the first time I went back was, as I mentioned before, it was in June 1945, because I received news from the first emissary who came from Krakow that there are a few Jews left, or few Jews who came back to Krakow already when the war ended, and that my mother is among them. Whereupon, I didn't think twice, I was at that time in the British Army. Details won't matter, I've organized myself transport, and I drove hell for leather day and night until I came to Krakow and knocked at my mother's door.
And she was home?
She was waiting for me. I would not have come without warning her because she would not have survived the shock. She knew that I was on the way. And often I took her with me. She lived with us still in London for 10 years. And I spent those 10 years, you could say, at her bedside, where she was telling me endlessly her story. And therefore, I feel I had sort of first-hand evidence from an eyewitness immediately after.
And what you've been doing ever since is collecting stories of other people.
Well, look, this is not terribly relevant to what we are saying, because I say I was collecting stories. This is not and could not have been my full-time job. I had to earn a living. So even though this is a lifelong interest, I led a normal life, and I have a family and a wife and children and grandchildren, and on the face of it, live a life which is indistinguishable from that of my neighbor.
What are some of the thoughts that come to your mind on this 50th anniversary of the start of the uprising?
I would like this to be remembered. I very often have the feeling that the memory of it only surfaces on anniversaries. But I think that it is necessary to know what had happened, how it happened, who was responsible for it, and what was lost in the process. I think it's necessary to remember it all the time.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Raphael Scharf edited the book In the Warsaw Ghetto, Summer 1941, featuring photographs of the ghetto and passages from ghetto diaries. It's published by Aperture. Our interview was recorded April 19th of this year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A recent poll suggests that more than 20% of the American people think it's possible the Holocaust never happened. Coming up, we talk with Deborah Lipstadt about the movement that is trying to rewrite history and deny the Holocaust happened. She says this movement shows the fragility of reason and society's susceptibility to far-fetched ideas. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Pelican Brief, starring Denzel Washington and Julia Roberts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. The White House is denying that it's given up trying to return exiled Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide to power. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
White House spokesman Dee Dee Myers denied a report in today's Los Angeles Times that U.S. policy in Haiti had failed after Prime Minister Robert Malvel was unable to set up a peace conference. Myers said the White House was disappointed in the pace of progress, but that the process was not dead. The United States is still committed to returning Aristide to power, but has not been able to do so despite a military blockade of Haiti and international economic sanctions. Underscoring Myers' remarks, Secretary of State Warren Christopher also stepped forward today to express his support for Aristide. Christopher also denied that there had been any change in U.S. policy toward Haiti. He said the U.S. was searching for new mechanisms to implement the Governor's Island Accord. That agreement attempted to map out a way for Haiti to return to democratic rule. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
In Algeria, the outlawed fundamentalist party, the Islamic Salvation Front, has set conditions for opening talks with the government. Alfred Hermida has more on the story.
The two sides in the Algerian conflict appear to be slowly edging towards talks aimed at ending 2 years of political violence. Last week, the military-backed authorities indicated they were willing to enter talks with figures who had once represented the Islamic Salvation Front, so long as they had not broken the law. But they ruled out direct negotiations with the party, as it no longer existed as a legal organization. The front has now put forward its conditions for dialogue. Speaking in Bonn, the president of the party's exiled leadership, Rabah Kabir, called for the release of all political prisoners and the repeal of laws introduced since the cancellation of elections 2 years ago. He also demanded the creation of an independent body to look into the decision to call off the poll, which the front was set to win. But in a significant shift, the party appears to have dropped a previous demand that the authorities respect the results of the elections.
Alfred Hermida for the BBC. The government says in November, builders started construction of new homes at the highest rate in nearly 4 years. Starts increased 3.9%, a somewhat stronger pace than analysts had expected. They credit low mortgage interest rates. The Commerce Department says the advance was powered by activity in the Northeast and the South. Housing starts were down in the Midwest and the West. Economist David Siders of the National Association of Home Builders says many of the houses are for people living in apartments who have wanted to buy their first home but have not been able to afford it until now. Sider says housing has become more affordable as mortgage interest rates have dropped. On Wall Street, stocks closed sharply higher. The Dow Jones Industrials gained more than 25 points to close at 3751.57. Advances led declines in heavy trading. This is NPR. The man accused of spraying gunfire around a Long Island commuter train says he has been abused by corrections officers and has asked a judge to replace his court-appointed lawyer. Colin Ferguson says officers have attacked him with a milk carton and a fire extinguisher, left his cell lighted 24 hours a day, and denied him soap. Ferguson is accused of killing 6 people and wounding 7. Authorities say the shootings appear to be racially motivated. Ferguson is black. The attorney he has requested is also black. His current lawyer is white. The current lawyer has refused to discuss whether race is involved in the request for the change. The judge has refused to rule until after Ferguson is examined to see if he's competent to stand trial. Dr. Jack Kevorkian, charged with violating Michigan's law banning assisted suicide, has been released from jail after a judge reduced his bond from $50,000 to $100 cash. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
Kevorkian Kevorkian has been released from the Oakland County Jail. He has promised Judge Jessica Cooper that he will not assist in any more suicides until the State Court of Appeals rules on a constitutional challenge to the law, which makes helping someone kill themselves a felony. The 65-year-old Right to Die advocate is expected to spend the next several days in the hospital. He will now end a hunger strike he began when jailed 18 days ago. Since June of 1990, Kevorkian has been present at 20 suicides. He had been facing criminal charges in three of those deaths, but earlier this week, a Detroit judge dropped one of the charges, saying the state's assisted suicide ban is too broad. The Michigan Court of Appeals has scheduled oral arguments on the law for January 4th. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
A Postal Service spokesman says Monday is expected to be the busiest day of the year for postal workers as Americans mail holiday gifts and greetings. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Hitler never planned to exterminate the Jews. Jews were not gassed in Auschwitz. There was no Holocaust. The Holocaust is a hoax dreamed up by the Jews to get money and sympathy for the State of Israel. Those statements are transparently untrue, and yet there's a growing movement of people who are trying to rewrite history by saying the Holocaust never happened. Deborah Lipstadt says that this pseudo-scholarship is a threat not just to Jewish history, but to all who believe in the ultimate power of reason. In her book, Denying the Holocaust, she examines the workings of the Holocaust denial movement and its assault on truth and memory. Lipstadt is a professor of modern Jewish and Holocaust studies at Emory University. When we spoke last July, she told me there's evidence that the movement is making inroads.
There was a Roper poll on this very question, and the Roper organization asked people, Americans, is it possible that the Holocaust didn't happen? And 20% of Americans and 22% of high school students said, yes, it was possible. Now, I recognize that if you were to ask Americans, is it possible that John F. Kennedy is alive and well and living in the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia, some would say, yes, it's possible. Or is it possible that Elvis is, you know, living in the Liberty Bell? They might say, yes, it's possible. Americans, you know, there's always going to be a small core that's going to be willing to consider any notion. But even when you factor that out, that response is a response that's disturbing.
Well, as you say in your book, you're studying this to try to understand the fragility of reason and society's susceptibility to far-fetched ideas. So you see this as a case study in our susceptibility to far-fetched ideas.
Absolutely. I did not write this book solely about the attack on the Holocaust or the attack on an aspect of Jewish history, which is, of course, something that concerned me. But I am really concerned if this history is not safe, then no history is safe. If this memory is not safe, no memory is safe. And with the ferment in the world right now, history is up for grabs.
Now, you're often invited onto TV talk shows to debate people from the Holocaust denial movement, and you refuse to debate them. Why?
Categorically, I refuse, and it amazes some people because here I have a new book coming out, and any author wants every bit of PR and any vehicle to promote their book. But I have refused at least four or five national TV shows and numerous local shows and radio shows. I won't debate people who are liars. I will debate someone who wants to argue that, Hitler, the orders came from Hitler, or they came from subordinates up, you know, the idea for the Holocaust came from the bottom, came from the top. I will debate someone who thinks the Holocaust is unique in terms of its barbarity, or someone who doesn't. Lots of things to debate and lots of differences to discuss here. But I can't debate people who are outright liars, who have no fidelity to the truth, who will just say this didn't happen or this happened or there are no documents, et cetera, et cetera. There's no room for debate there. And I won't give them the credibility of being the other side. See, that's what they want. That's their agenda. That's exactly what they wanted to do on campus. They want to be thought of at this point as the other side of a debate. And that's why they call themselves revisionists. I don't use that term because they're not revising anything. They're denying. But they want to be thought of as simply people exploring the truth. That's how they wrap themselves in this cloak of truth. And the truth is that they're exactly the opposite.
Let's look at the history of the Holocaust denial movement. You trace it to after the war in France
where it really starts seriously. What are the first signs of it after the war in France?
Well, you begin to get a number of Frenchmen who begin to say that the stories are exaggerated, that this can't quite be true, that we don't know if it's precisely as it happened. But in those early years, you're yet to have people saying the gas chambers didn't happen, to say it's an outright hoax, it's an outright fraud. That begins to happen actually in part in France and then picked up very quickly in the United States shortly thereafter. So you've had people trying to deny this from the 1950s, most of them from the extreme, extreme right, political right wing. And they have not only a anti-Semitic, but also a white supremacist agenda.
Well, one of the early people in the United States that said the Holocaust has been exaggerated was George Lincoln Rockwell, who was the head of the American Nazi Party. Now, I guess it was easy for Americans to dismiss him because, I mean, everybody knows that he's an extremist. Everybody knows he's anti-Semitic. But did then people come along who were less easy to dismiss?
That's exactly what's happened today. In fact, it started, I would say, about a decade and a half ago. That up until then, you could write these people off because it was the George Lincoln Rockwells, or it was even the David Dukes, but it was David Duke running around in his sheet and his cone head or whatever the costume is that he wore when he was Ku Klux Klan magician or wizard or whatever the name is. But what the deniers began to do in the late 70s is shed that cloak and don a cloak of pseudo-academic respectability. So they began to publish books. There's one professor of electrical engineering in Northwestern University who published a book denying the Holocaust, The Hoax of the 20th Century, it's called. And it has small margins and lots of footnotes and densely printed, and it looks terribly boring. So people think that, oh, this must be a serious book. And they began to run academic conferences or pseudo-academic conferences to publish a journal that looked like an academic journal, so much so that an honors student at Yale who was studying history, when he saw the description of the journal, didn't see the journal itself, but saw the description of the journal in a bibliography of journals, sent them a paper he had written in one of his Yale classes because he thought, oh, this sounds like a respectable operation, and much to his mortification discovered that he was published in a denial journal. He was sent $250 by the deniers for the article, and I often say if he had been more experienced, that would have been a clue to him that this wasn't an academic journal because academic journals don't pay and don't publish so quickly. But in any case, that's what they've been doing. They've been cloaking themselves in this aura of respectability, reason, dialogue, and it fools people.
If someone denying the Holocaust starts quoting texts from the movement that sound scholarly and that outsiders don't know is published by the movement, it sounds like, well, you've got evidence, don't you?
Exactly. What they engage in what has been described as a merry-go-round, a cross-fertilization of one quoting the other, quoting the other, quoting the other. Or they'll sponsor a study of gas chambers, which purports to be a serious scientific study, which of course is not. And then they'll quote it as proof, scientific proof that the Holocaust didn't happen. So you get this circular kind of one depending on the other.
My guest is Deborah Lipstadt. She teaches modern Jewish and Holocaust studies at Emory University. She's the author of the new book, Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Deborah Lipstadt is my guest, author of the new book, Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory. I'm sure you've asked yourself a lot, why is there a group of people who are trying to deny that the Holocaust happened or are trying to downplay what happened during the Holocaust? What conclusions have you come to about that?
Well, I think there are a number of ways of trying to understand these people. Many of them, some of them are kooks and quacks, flat earth theorists. People, you know, one of them wrote a book, the Hitler's secret weapon, UFOs, unidentified flying objects, Hitler's secret weapon. They're, you know, so some of them really border on the gray area of rational thinking. Some of them are absolute burning anti-Semites. Some are neo-Nazis and philo-Germans. And some are conspiracy theorists, you know, who see a conspiracy all about. And some are a combination of all the above. Many of them are from the far right wing. Not only, but many are from the far right wing. And many of them have a white supremacist agenda.
You make an interesting point in your book that early on there were a lot of fascists who were in the Holocaust denial movement. And they wanted to disconnect fascism from the Holocaust because the Holocaust just made fascism seem really bad. So to cleanse the idea of fascism, they wanted to downplay or deny the Holocaust.
That's exactly one of the main points I'm trying to make, because while it happened early on, it's happening even more now. If the neo-Nazis and the fascists, or I don't know if we call them neo or Nazis and the fascists, but contemporary Nazis and fascists, if they can convince people that the Holocaust didn't happen, then what's so wrong with National Socialism? What's so wrong with Nazism? What's so wrong with fascism? And consequently, Holocaust denial has proven to be very alluring to a lot of extremist nationalists, even intellectuals or academics in the former Eastern Bloc countries, who are very much attracted by a strong-willed right-wing government such as a National Socialist government, but who are repelled by the Holocaust. So if you can remove the Holocaust, then what's so wrong with National Socialism? After all, they bombed London, we bombed Cologne. They had camps, Buchenwald and Dachau, well, we had camps for the Japanese-Americans. There's no comparison between the camps, the Japanese-American camps, which were horrible, but there's no comparing them in their horror to what Buchenwald and Dachau were all about. But they deal in immoral equivalencies. And the only immoral equivalency that they can't find a parallel for is the Holocaust.
There's an institute that's one of the centers for the Holocaust denial movement called the Institute for Historical Research. You say that they're funded, at least in part, by the Liberty Lobby. What's the Liberty Lobby?
It's the Institute for Historical Review, the IHR, based in California. And the Liberty Lobby is one of the most far-right entities we have in this country. It publishes things like the Liberty Bell and the Spotlight, and a whole nexus, if not directly connected with them, indirectly connected, a far-right kind of publications. The money, they have had the same mailing address as the Institute for Historical Review, the same people right at the helm of one, at the helm of the other. So there's very little question about the connection between the two.
You see Holocaust revisionism as just like a case study in how people are trying to rewrite the past with what they're passing off as facts but are just lies. What are some of the other examples of that you see around now?
Well, I think there's an attempt to play with history of African Americans on both sides. There are those who argue that slavery was not so bad, there are others who argue that Afrocentrists who argue that while Africa hasn't gotten its rightful place, which I think they're right in many educational systems, argue that Africa is the cradle for all. Everything that came out that's useful to society has come out of there. I think they're those kinds of revisionist views of history. I think there'll be others that'll come along. We see it in Bosnia-Herzegovina. We see it in lots of places. This attempt to attack history to rewrite history. History is the new battleground.
Why is history the new battleground? I mean, most Americans consider themselves to be totally uninterested in history. The word history is such a turnoff.
Right, people get bored the minute they hear, oh, that's history. In fact, you know, that's the greatest, one of the great put-downs is your history.
Right.
You know, I'm not sure, but I think that we've seen, this attack on history connects with something else, with another intellectual movement, which was very popular the past 10 years, and that's deconstructionism. And I don't mean this to be an attack on deconstructionism, but what deconstructionism argued is that a text has no set meaning. It's the interpretation that the reader brings to the text. And deconstructionism has something to recommend it. It says that voices such as women's voices or people of color voices weren't heard in interpretation of text. But then when people who really didn't understand the movement got a hold of it, and even some who did understand it, and took it to its lowest common denominator, what happened was there's an inability to say, this is nonsense. There's an inability to say, this makes no sense, or this is wrong. It sort of backed into or came in confluence with a moral relativism that has permeated much of American life, starting in academic circles and moving out. It's a fuzzy kind of reasoning, which I find very frightening.
Do you think history has become the new battleground in part because in our search for identity, for roots, for our historical place, our personal historical place in the world, history has become a tool more than it ever has, I think, in American popular culture for giving us a personal identity?
Absolutely. I think people want an anchor. And I think one of the anchors is history. And if the history doesn't exist, I'll make it up. If the history isn't there, I'll adopt it and adapt it to make it my own. And it makes it it's a very fragile instrument. Memory is a very fragile thing. And that's why I think places like the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum are so important, because it's a historical museum that shows the history of National Socialism and the destruction of so many human beings, Jews and non-Jews.
So by manipulating history, you're also manipulating identity.
Absolutely. You're playing with people's identity. And part of, if people don't have an identity and they want to create it, they rewrite history in order to have that identity. But I think the important thing, going back to the actual Holocaust deniers, is that they're also trying to, they have the anti-Semitic agenda, they have the neo-Nazi agenda, and they have an anti-Israel agenda, and they have this sort of conspiracy theory agenda, and they have found that history is the right vehicle to try to advance those agendas.
Deborah Lipstadt is the author of Denying the Holocaust. This is music composed by Gideon Klein while he was in the concentration camp Theresienstadt. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing about the reports of a change in U.S. policy on the practicality of returning the elected president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, to power. And we'll also be hearing about the settlement of a major sex discrimination suit with a Los Angeles or a West Coast-based supermarket chain. Also today, the story of a very controversial decision by the Patent Office about CD-ROM technology, a decision that's now going to be reviewed. And we'll be talking with the president of the Encyclopedia Britannica Company about why we shouldn't expect to be reading the Britannica on CD-ROM anytime soon.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Julia Roberts hasn't had a major movie role since she played Tinkerbell in Hook back in 1991, and yet she's rarely been out of the headlines over the past couple of years. Roberts is said to be the biggest female movie star in America, even when she's not starring in any movies. But what about when she is? Her new picture, The Pelican Brief, opens today. Film critic Stephen Schiff went to have a look.
I've never been quite as nuts for Julia Roberts as a lot of people seem to be, but I think I see how her particular brand of screen magic works. That smile of hers is a real dazzler, all white and dimply and huge, with five or six moving parts the rest of us don't seem to have. In a Julia Roberts movie, the smile goes on, just enough to addict you to it, and then it goes off. Trouble arises, something makes her unhappy, and we in the audience get hooked into the movie because we want the trouble resolved so that Julia can treat us to that smile again. One of the problems with The Pelican Brief is that Julia doesn't give us a chance to bask in her smile. She's earnest and furrow-browed right from the beginning, and that's because she's pretending to be very, very intelligent. How else to play Darby Shaw, a Tulane University law student who impresses her teacher, Tom Callahan, played by Sam Shepard, and also sleeps with him. Poor Callahan hasn't seen much of Darby lately, though, because she's been working away in the library day and night, trying to solve the crime that has captured the nation's attention. Two Supreme Court justices have been murdered, and no one has a clue why. Darby puts her guess about the killer's identity in a brief. Yep, the Pelican brief. And gives it to Callahan, who passes it on as a curiosity to a friend in the FBI. Mistake. Pretty soon, Callahan's dead, and Darby's on the run. The only person she thinks she can trust is an investigative reporter at a newspaper very like the Washington Post. His name is Gray Grantham, and he's played by Denzel Washington, also very earnest and furrow-browed.
Now, if your brief is right, and it ever reaches the light of day, the president has lost any chance for re-election. There are men around the president that won't let that happen. I checked with all my sources last night at the Bureau, Langley, the White House. All of them said the brief doesn't exist, never has. You may be the only witness that can ever prove there was a brief. If you disappear, so does justice. Is that what Callahan would want?
Thomas would want me to see my 25th birthday.
Darby, if this thing reaches as deep and goes as high as we think it does, these men will do anything not to be exposed. Where can you hide?
This is the second adaptation of a John Grisham bestseller to hit movie screens in 1993. The first one was called The Firm. This one ought to be called The Soft. Nothing in it quite holds up, and the premise is too mushy to support the frantic, awkwardly directed chases that dominate the movie. Everybody strides through the Pelican Brief, barking out suspense movie cliches and looking deeply concerned, but the film remains strangely unconvincing. While they're all up there scrambling, we're out here shrugging. And there's another thing. You're watching the brave reporter and his braver deep throat and all the murky scenes in parking garages and a conspiracy that goes all the way to the White House, and you're thinking, right, this poor director thinks he can make a movie as good as All the President's Men. And then you realize the director of the Pelican Brief is Alan J. Pakula. He did make All the President's Men. And that's when the Pelican Brief stops seeming silly and starts seeming a little sad.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Chris Fraley, and Richard Parker. Devin Reif is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, an actress who likes to break convention in her work and life. We talk with Jeanne Moreau, the star of such French New Wave film classics as Jules and Jim, The Lovers, and Elevator to the Gallows. She's starring in a new film called The Summer House. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.